Hello and welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast. This is Mark Williams broadcasting to you from cloudy Cambridgeshire in the UK. Now, it's always good to speak to people with real-world experience of sustainable transport and shipping in particular, so today's guest fits the bill perfectly. Gavin Allwright is Secretary General of the International Wind Ship Association. He's been in this role since 2014, and he's passionate about promoting wind propulsion for commercial shipping worldwide. Now, the International Wind Ship Association is a forum for all industry stakeholders, experts, academics, and NGO supporters in the development of a wind ship sector to shape industry as well as shape government's attitudes and policies. Gavin sits on the Ship Efficiency Subgroup of the European Sustainable Shipping Forum, which is led by the European Commission DG of Transport. He also sits on the Stakeholders Advisory Committee of the IMO Maritime Technologies Cooperation Centres Programme, and he is a non-executive board member of the World Wind Energy Association. Gavin has a master's degree in sustainable development, specialising in small-scale sustainable shipping and logistics in developing countries. He has contributed to numerous studies and projects on alternative propulsion solutions and has helped coordinate and contributed extensively to the UN-affiliated International Renewable Energy Agency technical brief, Renewable Energy Options in Shipping. So if you want to know about wind propulsion in shipping, this is the man to speak to. So Gavin, welcome to the podcast.
Mark, thank you for the introduction as well. You make me sound very official there. Thank you.
It's my job. So, Gavin, for the benefit of our listeners who don't know, International Windship Association has been around for about 8 years now. Could you describe your work for our listeners who aren't acquainted with your organisation, please?
Yeah, sure. So the association, as you mentioned earlier, was set up in 2014. And one of the big parts of the association's work is to expand the membership, but also to create a network, collaboration network within that membership. And we have over 130 active members now, including class, large shipping companies, technology providers, of course, research and development centers, etc. So there's a lot of network development. We also, obviously, we promote what wind propulsion is and what potential it has for fuel saving or for the propulsive energy provision to commercial vessels. And that includes a lot of conferences, a lot of articles, press releases, etc. We also have quite an active education program as well. So we go into universities, schools, colleges, that type of thing, and really bringing in a very positive message of development and new ideas coming through the shipping industry. And I think that's a really important part of the work that we do. And I would say the final big area is around policy and regulation. And you know, I'm not always the smartest guy in the room, but we pull together all of the smart guys, get them in a room, and we go over the policy development, regulations in IMO, in the EU, national regulations as well. And also looking at the decarbonisation pathways and trying to really integrate wind into the heart of those pathways. And that's a lot of meetings, a lot of information being exchanged as well.
Do you find governments in general, the ones you speak to, are receptive to the idea of wind energy for shipping?
It's certainly changed over the years. When we first set up, no, it was not very receptive, seen as a very peripheral idea, something harking back to a golden age. These days, now it's really come up the agenda. We're seeing, especially in IMO, in the EU, a real understanding that this is one of the low-hanging fruit technologies. It's a, if you like, it's a technology of no regret. You know, once you've installed this, you're basically getting a zero emissions, free energy source for the lifetime of the vessel. So once you've repaid the capex or you're leasing the equipment, you know, it's a way to kick off that decarbonisation very quickly, and that's attracting a lot of attention, as you can imagine.
I think the industry is probably more behind wind power than perhaps the governments have been, or it's been more quick to decide that this is a good thing than perhaps the governments have been. And I'll tell you why I say that. We've just completed a survey at Ship Energy. We asked one question. Do you think, it was particularly to do with bulk carriers, this survey, do you think that bulk carrier owners will fit vessels with wind-assisted power, such as rotor sails or kite sails? And we said that we offered them the options to say yes, and this will start before 2030. And yes, and this will start before 2030, but only for smaller vessels. Or yes, and this will start after 2030. Or yes, this will start after 2030, but only for smaller vessels. Or no, I don't think this will happen, or I'm not allowed to say, and I don't know. So about 20%, 21% of respondents said, I don't think this will happen, or I don't know. So the great majority, 79%, said this is going to happen. And of those, 46% believe it will start before 2030. So pretty much half of people involved in dry bulk operations do believe that wind-assisted power is practically here now, either for retrofit or for new buildings. So that must be very encouraging.
No, absolutely. It does reflect the intelligence that we have from the market as well, that this is not, how can I say, it's not mainstream technology just yet, but it's coming into there. And mm-hmm. The interesting thing is, when you look at the companies that are already engaging publicly with wind propulsion, these are major players, you know, companies like MOL, Oldendorf, K-Lines, Louis Dreyfus Amateur. Yeah, these are major players in the industry taking it very, very seriously. So, yes, encouraging indeed.
Now, of course, there's a sort of corporate social responsibility element to this. People want to be seen as good corporate citizens, and the ESG motivation is there. But, of course, we now have the IMO regulations that stipulate we have to decarbonize. And I suppose there must be a commercial side to this. You know, ship owners can see, if I fit this, I will presumably save enough money on fuel to make it pay itself back over a limited amount of time.
No, absolutely. Those drivers, I mean, any one of those drivers would move the market forward. But the fact is that they're all here. They're all coming in together. But if we strip away the regulatory aspect and we strip away the ESG aspect, the commercial offering here is strengthening by the day, if you like. We're seeing, you know, sort of for a standard kit going onto ships, you know, not ones that retract, or but a standard piece of kit going onto a vessel, you're looking at ROIs in the 3 to 4 years around the price of, say, $600 per tonne of fuel. Mm-hmm. That three-year period for the industry is certainly the sweet spot. Anything under that, then you've really got a good commercial discussion. I think MGO's already at about 690 today or yesterday. You know, HFO with a carbon tax, say the ETS, would push it into that $600 mark. And that's before any of the alternative fuels come in, which we're expecting to be a number of times more expensive than the current fossil fuels. So that's going in the right direction, just at exactly the same time as the price or the cost of the units is going to start dropping. You know, we're seeing probably a learning curve of around 10% for every doubling of capacity delivered to the market. So by the end of this year, or Q1 next year, will be about 20 vessels in operation, large, with about 40 rigs on board. We're likely to see that double again in 2022, with COVID, you know, issues there possibly leaking into Q1 23. So that doubling is likely to continue year on year going towards 2030.
That's great to hear. Wind is clearly an ideal candidate for retrofit as well as for new buildings. But how do we transfer the technology from the wind power manufacturers to the shipyards? Are the shipyards going to be able to license to manufacture these things under license to, you know, enable their own design teams? Are they going to have to work very hard to work out how to retrofit these onto existing vessels?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. And I think there's going to be, I doubt there'll be a one-size-fits-all on this, but we're already seeing a number of our members that are setting up production lines in closer to the shipbuilding centres. So China, the Far East, etc. Building up the expertise there, close by to the shipyards. So you've got engineers on hand to install these, but also developing that know-how and that understanding of the systems for maintenance as well. Mm-hmm. So we've got to build up that core of engineers that really do understand this equipment. But we're also seeing companies aligning with larger players in the market. So, for example, a recent one, Bahr Technologies, is just linked up with Yara Marine. So they have a lot of that expertise to bring that into the yards. You know, there's others. Alfa Laval has just matched up with Ocean Bird for a new build contract. But it's the same thing. You know, they're bringing, rather than small SME technology providers scaling up dramatically, mm-hmm. they're looking for those collaborative business deals and mergers, etc.
I see. So that is all starting to happen. And I suppose the shipyards were able to work with and then assume the ability to install scrubber systems, for instance. So, they're pretty quick on the uptake when it comes to new technology.
Yeah, and as these become more standardized as well, obviously with 15 ships, it's pretty much you're looking at systems that are bespoke for that vessel. But the producers are standardizing these. The shipyards, that's what they want. They want a standard unit on their equipment lists that they can literally plug into the design on request. That process is starting to happen.
Well, that's good to see. And I suppose, yes, because there are lots of different bespoke systems, whether they're kites or sails or rotor sails. Or where's the interest these days? Where's the research and development focused at the moment?
Well, as a membership organization, it's everywhere. Everybody's interested. All the technology is fantastic. But just currently, I can give you an idea of some of the installations that are coming online at the moment. So we have, I think, 10 vessels with rotor sails from different companies already in place. And actually, Scandlines has just announced a new installation a few days ago. So that will be going on early 2020. And that's their second, actually. That's their second installation. So the rotor sails have probably made the early running and got up to that kind of level of having 3 or 4 reference points within the industry for the industry to take a look at and validate savings, etc. What we're seeing now is quite a few of the rigid sails or hard sail developers are now coming into the market. So we're having announcements of installations for next year. And there's a number of soft sail projects underway. There's a new build underway by the Ariang for a RoRo, which is wind assist, to deliver rocket parts across the Atlantic, which is going to be exciting. That will be launched next year, late next year. And we've got the first installation of a kite for the last few years, a first installation that's going on in December. So that's coming through as well. One other group of technologies is the Ventafoil or suction sail or e-sail. And this is a system that was developed by Jacques Cousteau's team and Bertrand Charrier. And that has a fan inside a stubby wing, which sucks in the boundary layer of the wind going around the wing. So it increases the lift from that. And we have a couple of companies that have, I think, 3 installations of those at the moment. And there's another couple. One's just gone to a shipyard in Spain for a fourth installation. Mm-hmm. And another one's been announced for December this year. So there's movement in all of the segments at the moment.
Vento lift. That where is that wing located? Is that on the forward part of the superstructure, or?
Well, that's interesting. 2 of the installations are on the bow. The most recent one, which is on a fishing vessel, was on the stern. Partly because you don't want to have too much kit on your working area on a fishing vessel. Yep. So they actually located that on the stern.
Interesting. But okay.
I would say most likely those are going to be on the bow. Actually, there's a movable system which uses a flat rack system. So a kind of container base. Mm-hmm. And then so they can be moved by the hatch crane on a small bulk to get them out of the way. They can actually be stowed just in front of the wheelhouse as well during loading and unloading.
Are they being used to generate forward motion, or are they charging a battery? Or
No. All of the systems are used for direct propulsion. There are some turbine developments that are going on that could be both. But no, they use electricity as opposed to generating it.
Okay, I see. In that list, I remember reading a couple of years ago, there was a French firm called Neoline, which was going to build ro-ro vessels for transporting cars, I think, from Renault across the Atlantic, if my memory serves me right. And they were due to be launched. They were going to be sail-powered vessels due to be launched this year. Have you had any involvement with that project? Is that going ahead?
Yeah, they're members of ours. And, you know, obviously there's been some delays over the last couple of years with COVID and a number of other things. They're getting very close to the build now. So they've been lining up in the meantime as there's been these delays. And it's a big project. You know, they're looking at 230, 140 meter ro-ros that are primary wind. So you really want to, you know, there's no shame in going back and looking again at your designs to really optimize those systems. And they're looking at possibly 80% reduction in fuel. Obviously going slower than a motor vessel of the same size, but they've been lining up other cargo owners. So I believe Michelin is putting some of their tires for the return trip over from America back to France. Okay. Hennessy Cognac, as you mentioned, Renault for car parts and cars themselves. And interestingly, you know, as they've been developing their system, we've also had another Swedish company called Oceanbird, which is tied up with Alfa Laval. So I think it's going to be called Alfa Val because it's Wallenius Marine. So Alfa Val, Oceanbird in the future. And they've designed specifically a car carrier, which should be built and operated by Wallenius Wilhelmsen in 2024, more likely to be 2025. So some really interesting, they're talking 80, 90% savings on North Atlantic routes as well. So some very interesting projects.
Okay, so yeah, I guess once the European Union brings shipping under the ETS, where we can expect to see greater momentum behind wind ships.
Yeah, it certainly makes sense. I mean, with the CII as well, that's being developed by IMO. I mean, again, if you've got more expensive fuel, we're talking about a system that just saves you that cost. So if it's a retrofit especially, you're saving money from day one. And you know, as the prices increase, as alternative fuels come into the market at high prices, that's going to be a very serious competitive advantage issue. Mm. So if you're incorporating, say, a 20% propulsive power delivered by wind along with some operational changes, so if you slow down a vessel, it saves fuel. But one other thing that it does, which the industry doesn't really appreciate just at the moment, is you increase the percentage that wind can deliver. So the slower you go, the more percentage you can actually save from the fuel that's remaining. But things like weather routing as well is increasing in sophistication. Yep. So if you route for wind, you can actually reduce that quite dramatically again. And then, of course, doing other ship efficiency measures on the vessel. You know, it's quite possible to reduce the propulsive energy or deliver and reduce the amount of propulsive energy up to 2/3. And that leaves that 1/3 over for the eco-fuels to come in. So, you know, wind's also a very big facilitating technology for the total decarbonisation.
Yeah, I hadn't realised that if you slow down wind, it can be a greater proportion of the total amount of energy that the vessel consumes for. Now, I believe the Wind Ship Association has just announced or recently announced the campaign, The Decade of Wind Propulsion.
Yes.
And you mentioned a sort of doubling of installations over the coming decade. But do you have a target for market penetration for wind propulsion? Or what's your vision? Is it that it's just the natural thing in the future that all kinds of ships have wind propulsion on them?
Yeah, I mean, 100% next year would be lovely. I just thought I'd push that out there. You never know. Yeah, we have our internal, you know, optimistic calculations, but what we usually use are a couple of third-party forecasts for the uptake of wind. Mm-hmm. So an EU report that was done actually back in 2016, and we're hoping to get an updated one done, calculated that if wind propulsion systems were coming into the market in 2020, so if you like 2021, if you factor in COVID delays,
yeah,
then that would be estimated up to 10,700 installations by the end of the decade.
Okay.
And that pretty much, if we doubled installations each year, that would reach around about 10,000. The other one is the UK Clean Maritime Plan, which was put together in July 2019. And that took this out to 2050. And in 2050, they were looking at a market penetration of around 40 to 45%, about 40,000 vessels.
Mm-hmm.
We think both of those are conservative. This could, if we make the choice to move, this could be moved much quicker. And I'll give you one reason behind that is if it's a retrofit system that you're looking at, we're pretty much looking at deck equipment here. And that lends itself to potentially for leasing or even modular systems. So if that was to take off, or a kind of pay-as-you-save model,
mm-hmm.
that removes that very heavy cap aspect at the beginning.
Yeah.
And you're pretty much paying for it with the fuel savings. That could be the tilt point or the tipping point for uptake across the industry. The nice problem will then be having enough systems ready to install and having enough yards to actually put them on. So
having that manufacturing and assembly and installation infrastructure capable of doing that. Infrastructure and capability and capacity, of course, is the question mark over all the parts of the energy transition at the moment, whether you're trying to produce hydrogen or make enough of any kind of new technology.
Yeah. No, indeed. And actually, that's another benefit on more of a macro level with wind. You know, it doesn't require any land-based infrastructure except for the installation. But we're also looking at, I can give you an example, the Scandlines ferry that I was talking about. They had the foundation plate for the rotor sail was put in, I think, in one of their regular maintenance calls or dry dock calls. Took a couple of days to weld that into place, test it, etc. The actual rotor itself was put on during a stop of the ferry on its regular route. So it came in something like 5 o'clock in the afternoon, was leaving about 12 hours later.
Mm-hmm.
I think it took about 5 hours to install it. And that says it. And then she was using it the next morning. So, you know, certain systems, you know, the simple systems, simple direct systems can be installed quite quickly and efficiently.
So it doesn't sound like there are very many drawbacks, if any. we should all be doing this. There was a quote from a senior automobile manufacturing executive in the Financial Times this week. He said, "We have reached the inflection point, you know, where we switch off manufacturing of internal combustion engine vehicles, and we switch over to either pure electric or hybrid hydrogen electric. So, for instance, the Toyota Prius is now going to be hydrogen electric from 2020. And Mercedes, I think, have said after 2025, they will not develop any further internal combustion engines. And I think the Mercedes Group is the fourth or fifth largest manufacturer in the world. So it feels like that inflection point in decarbonising road transport is coming very soon. Do you get the same sense that we're getting to an inflection point for ocean transport?
I think it's going to take a little bit more time. I think that because of the infrastructure that's required for the alternative fuel side of things, that land-based investment is really huge. And you've got to have those fuels available pretty much around the world at the same time. So I think we saw this with LNG, which took probably 15 years to roll out to where we are today. And still there, it's patchy in places. So I think 2030 for the alternative fuel side of things, 2030 to 2040, that decade, there will be that inflection point there.
Yeah.
I think for wind propulsion, because it's available today and we've got a really robust pipeline coming through, I think that it will become standardized. I'd like to optimistically say to it by 2025, but certainly in the second half of the decade, I expect every single shipyard to be able to deliver this on standard, their standard equipment list. And pretty much most ship owners will be coming in and saying, you know what, this just makes sense. So why don't I put that on? And that makes me compliant with CII until maybe 2035 or something like that. That takes a lot of pressure off the ship owners. They can wait to see which of the alternative fuels kind of wins the race, in a sense.
Yeah.
And that's a much heavier commitment from them to switch over not just a ship, but a whole fleet to a certain type of fuel is a big undertaking. So,
Recently, we had Hal Malone as a podcast guest, and Hal has been working on the Marine Money Decarbonization Index and an ETF for people to invest in low carbon technology for shipping. And he recounted to me an anecdote about talking to a ship owner who said, "Hal, this is harder than going back to university. I have to make all these decisions, and I don't have enough information. And the difference between now and at university is at university I was allowed to get things wrong. Now I have to get it right." But it sounds like wind propulsion is the no-brainer here. Like, this is the easy one to go for, because you can do it and you can make it cost-effective and you can take the advantages from it while you wait for new forms of low-carbon fuel to arrive.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the big sales points is it's compatible with all of these fuels as well. It's compatible with your HFO all the way through to your green hydrogen. So you don't have to, it's not a trade-off. And I think that that's quite attractive, especially, your survey was interesting. First movers and early adopters have already started putting their chess pieces out there in around wind propulsion. That sort of middle group of maybe later adopters are starting to move to the, yes, this makes sense, we can do this. And with that repayment kind of scale, it's not going to cost the earth. Will they put this on very old ships? Not likely, unless it's modularized, but on ships that they need to make compliant. And I think that there's going to be a huge number of ships that have to be compliant with CII in that second half of this decade. It makes a lot of sense. You'll always have 20 to 30% of the industry that is absolutely regulation compliance driven. They will not move until they are actually forced to move. And so if we get 70% of the industry coming on board, maybe in 2 years' time, we'll have a 70%.
Okay. Well, fingers crossed for that.
I hope so.
Gavin, great to have you on. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
My pleasure.
Before we go, if any of our listeners would like to find out more, what's the website address for you?
We have two. We have our campaign website, which is decadeofwindpropulsion.org. I think we've got .com. And the main IWSA website is wind-ship.org.
Wind-ship.org. Okay.
Yes.
So that's the place to start. And Gavin, thanks for letting us know about the website, but there's something else that I think our listeners might be interested in. Can you tell us about your Windship Association Awards, please?
Yes, this is the Wind Propulsion Innovation Awards that we're running at the moment. The shortlist is being created by about 25 leading shipping and logistics experts from about 85 submissions that we've had across 7 categories. Those will be shortlisted down to about 5 in each category. And 4 of the categories are going to public vote, and a few of them are going to vote from our members only. But these cover all kinds of innovations, projects, programs, etc. So it'll be a virtual award ceremony on the second to last day of COP26 as well.
Good to know. Thanks very much for that. Okay, everyone, you can look out for those awards online and virtually at COP26. Well, great. Gavin Allwright, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate you taking the time. And thank you to everyone out there in podcast land. And we'll be back soon with another edition of the Ship Energy Podcast. Thanks again and bye for now.
Thanks very much. Fair winds to all.